Welcome, everyone, to The LaRouche Show. This is September 28th, and I'm your host for today, Marcia Mary Baker. Now, before I make even the necessary announcements, I want to say right away we are very pleased to have as our guest today Helga Zepp LaRouche. She's on the line from Germany. Many of you know many things about her. That is, she's president and founder of the Schiller Institute. Many of you know she's the wife of Lyndon LaRouche. And in particular, though, she is the leader of the political party that is Solidarity Civil Rights Movement, the party that ran in the federal elections. They took place September 22nd, last Sunday, and played a critical role in policy shifts going on in Germany and in the world. Helga is going to be giving us a report on breaking developments in the world picture. I'm going to turn to her in a few minutes, but first I have two announcements. One, politically, everyone should know in respect of strategic developments that Lyndon LaRouche, a few hours ago, has issued a very important open letter addressed to U.S. citizens and, in fact, addressed to people internationally at this time of crisis. I just want to say that because it's based, it addresses the real truth in U.S. national security policy, and he's issuing it through his LaRouche in 2004 campaign. Many media will pick it up. You will find it soon on our website where you are listening to The LaRouche Show. That is www.larouchepub.com in a few hours. The name of this document is called A Boldly Modest U.S. Global Mission, and it directly addresses what citizens need to think about at this time of crisis. Helga Zepp LaRouche will be discussing. And with that, let me just tell you, you can reach us with your direct questions during this coming hour. Those of you on the internet, you know that you just email us at radio@larouchepub.com. at any time, and many are listening on the conference call. Line your questions up. I'll be calling on you in a little bit. And finally, anyone who's on the internet and you want to call in directly, phone this number. This is if you're listening in the United States first, 1-866-857-4327. That's 866-857-4327. If you are listening outside the United States, anywhere internationally, you call us. Call the country code and then call 703-443-8419. That is U.S., the country code, then area code 703-443-8419. Hello, Helga, and please go right ahead now. I'm so glad you're here.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I think we had in Germany just the most important and also fascinating election campaign I can think of, because everybody understood that we are in an absolutely unprecedented crisis, and that, you know, this is not an election campaign like usual, but we were talking about the existence of Germany, the existence of Europe, war and peace. And, you know, therefore people reacted completely different than usual. Several months ago, the Schröder government was lagging behind in the polls quite significantly, because the unemployment in Germany is a very big factor. Officially, we have over 4 million unemployed, but de facto it's 7.5 million if you count all categories of people who are actually unemployed, and that is more than 1933. So that was the big issue. But then when it became clear that the war against Iraq was really coming closer, I think that Schröder clearly realized that if he would not address that issue, he would go nowhere. Up to that point, my party, the BÜSO, it's called, it's the Citizens Movement Solidarity, was the only force in all of Germany opposing this war. I and many other candidates pointed out to the uncalculable consequences such a war would have, you know, because the situation in the Middle East after the agreement of the Bush administration for Sharon's policies against the Palestinians is already a powder keg, because many, many Arabs and people in the region, you know, they see this, and there is already a complete break in respect to the relationship to the United States in particular. And then the war against Afghanistan already was understood by many people in the region to be the beginning of the clash of civilizations. So it was very clear that if now, in addition, there would be a war against Iraq, then, you know, this would cause a complete explosion. Because contrary to what American media are telling the population, you know, it's not at all a question of Saddam Hussein. The Arab people say enough is enough. The first Desert War was a tragedy. It was bombing Iraq back into the Stone Age, as it was said by the American commanders. But then in the 11 years of sanctions and continuous bombardment, more than 1 million children of Iraq have died. And all the Arab leaders and populations are saying, this people has suffered enough. So therefore, if you have now another attack, then you are threatening 1 billion Muslims being, you know, totally against the West. So we pointed to these obvious things, and, you know, as you know, Mr. LaRouche and I were in the Arab world in June, and I have some of these impressions from first-hand experience. So Schröder, who, if you remember, after the 11th bombing, had promised unconditional solidarity with the United States, realized that, you know, if Germany backs this war, then, you know, you would have a complete catastrophe, and Germany would get involved in incalculable things, because you would have an explosion of terrorism afterwards and so on. So Schröder, you know, somewhere in the summer months, changed his view on the war. And he said, absolutely no, Germany will not participate. Not one soldier will be deployed in this war. And that was really the key turning point, because he also already had picked up another programmatic point by the Büso. Those of you listeners who know us since a longer period of time know that Mr. LaRouche has since many, many years advocated the new Bretton Woods, to go back to the Franklin D. Roosevelt conference of 1944 to reorganize an otherwise hopelessly bankrupt world financial system. Now, in Franklin D. Roosevelt applied his particular method to lead the United States out of the Depression into, you know, becoming the strongest economic power. In Germany, a similar method was applied in the post-war reconstruction period with the famous bank, National Bank, the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau. And we had campaigned on that point that now we have a depression, we have a world financial meltdown, and we have to have the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau to play the role of a national bank in reconstruction. So Schröder picked up that point too. And when the big millennia flood came, you probably have followed this in the TV or media, there was a gigantic flood, mainly along the River Elbe, but also going then into, you know, all the countries around it, the Donau, Austria, Hungary, Czechia. I mean, there was a gigantic flood. And Schröder very forcefully then went in there and promised reconstruction methods, including using this bank of the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau. So it was that he addressed the economic issue based on programmatic points of the Büso, but then especially that he completely said no to the war, which made it possible that he came from behind, from very, very far behind, and actually had a marginal victory. So I think this was extremely important, because I think the fact that of all countries, Germany said no to the war, had a tremendous important effect internationally. I think it strengthened the opposition to the war, among other things, also in the United States. And, you know, I can only hope that the efforts by the U.S. to lean on the German government and try them to change their position is not going to have a success, because for Germany, it is really a question of absolute self-interest not to have this war. So this was a big victory. Now, let me just briefly mention another absolutely groundbreaking. Before I go to that, I should tell you that the Büso, my party, even if we did not get gigantic votes, even though we had marginal votes and significant votes for individual candidates, where we had direct candidates, but we had a tremendously successful election campaign with big election meetings, with always attended by 60, 80, 90, 100 people. So in this election campaign, there were actually thousands of people who came to these events, and we had an unprecedented degree of self-activation. You see, in Germany, you have a similar problem like in the United States, that the majority of the population is really not very politically active. So therefore, you know, all kinds of corrupt politicians can do what they want, because they never are asked for accountability. So the reason why the Büso is called Citizens Movement Solidarity, because, you know, we need a citizens movement, a civil rights movement. Sure, we have voting rights in Germany, that's not the problem, but we don't have state citizens who actually, you know, hold the politicians accountable. And in my view, a republic can only function if you have a majority of citizens who make sure the politicians and the government are accountable and are actually following the common good. So therefore, if you want to make a country function, you have to have a civil rights movement which consists out of state citizens who take responsibility. So from my standpoint, one of the big successes of this campaign is that we had an increasing number of people who basically say, the world is in such a crisis, we have to take responsibility, and, you know, we have to think like the chancellor, like the ministers, and, you know, think big, take responsibility. So that was accomplished, and people are very high-spirited, and they want to basically continue this campaign, because the world crisis is not over. What the Büso, despite an enormous black press boycott, succeeded in doing was that we put ourselves on the map, that we are the party which has a program to overcome the systemic crisis, that we demand a new Bretton Woods system, and that we demand the Eurasian land bridge. And since these are the issues which will remain after the election, I think we are in an excellent position for the coming fights. Now, another extremely important development is what happened in Italy this week. The Italian parliament took a majority vote on a resolution on the question of the new Bretton Woods to have a new financial architecture. Now, this is the result of long, long years of our work. As a matter of fact, you know, the La Rouge movement is active in Italy since almost 30 years. And we have many, many political friends in the church, in the different political parties, in the industries, in the various associations and so forth. And, you know, as you know, Lynn has been in Italy many times, invited by chambers of commerce and similar institutions. And in Italy, you have more people who study Lynn's ideas seriously, who read everything they can get a hold of, and who understand that Lynn is one of the outstanding thinkers of our present time, and who love him for that. So what happened is that already a couple of years ago, we had several parliamentarians introducing a new Bretton Woods resolution, And as the crisis is becoming worse, and people actually, you know, they see this system is going down, everything is in a meltdown. Argentina, you know, I mean, Argentina is very important for Italy because many Italians in the last centuries immigrated to Argentina. And now many of these people in the second, third, fourth generation come back to Italy because they cannot any longer live in Argentina because, you know, everything is collapsing. The country is sinking into chaos. Hundreds of thousands of people are living off the garbage. The banks have frozen the savings accounts. And, you know, the whole country is really going down the drain. Now, for Italy, which has lots of trade and other relations with Argentina, many family connections and so forth, it's like, you know, the horrible sign on the wall, what could be the fate of the whole world, including Italy. So therefore, you know, a big part of this resolution in the parliament was really to take certain emergency measures to defend Argentina. Lynn had proposed already, you know, I think a year ago or so when the Argentina crisis exploded, he had proposed a six-point program how to defend the Argentine people against the usurious banks and the IMF. So a lot of that went into this resolution, and then it expanded into, you know, the whole need to have a new Bretton Woods system, a new financial architecture. And one of the senators who were the sponsors of the resolution, Senator Bianchi, whom we know since many years, said to the parliament by vote motivating the adoption of this resolution that they should listen to the prophetic words of Mr. LaRouche, who was absolutely correct in predicting the collapse of the bubble, the speculative bubble, and who had proposed a new Bretton Woods, and that they could not leave him to be the only voice to be for such a new Bretton Woods. And then there was a vote, and it was passed with a majority. Now, this is very, very important because Italy, as you know, is the fifth largest economy in the world, and it is the first country of the G7 states to go with Lynn's proposals explicitly. Now, this is very big, and we have now a policy, you know, of the whole international organization. We are spreading the news about the Italian development. We have it out among all the parliaments. We have many contacts in many countries in parliaments who already, you know, signed previous appeals for a new Bretton Woods. And our aim is to replicate this before it is too late. Now, every day the markets are going down. You have new horror shows, new fraud investigations, new stock market meltdowns. Just yesterday they announced that they will close down the Nemax in Germany. That's the stock Buch for the new market. They just close it down because it collapsed to a ridiculous 300 points or so. And, you know, people know there is only one alternative, and that is the new Bretton Woods proposal by Lynn. So I think this is very optimistic news, especially because at another area of the Eurasian land bridge, namely in Southeast Asia and East Asia, our ideas are being put on the map too. You know that when Bush declared North Korea to be part of the axis of evil, this has sent shockwaves through the countries of East Asia. And in the recent period, there was a coordinated effort by Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea, who basically made agreements with Kim Jong-il, the president of North Korea, that they would go with the sunshine policy to, you know, basically try to move the two Koreas towards unification, to build the missing railway link in the demilitarized zone between South and North Korea, and then basically, you know, make sure that you know, North Korea is not being singled out. This is very much the concern of Russia. Putin, President Putin, went to Pyongyang and offered Russian help in the construction and modernization of the rail through North Korea, so that basically now you can soon travel all the way from Busan in South Korea to North Korea to China to Russia to Europe. And at the same time, a delegation went from Rome of industrialists to Pyongyang, and they announced that there is now a consortium of French, Italian, German industrialists who not only want to help the modernization of the rail in North Korea, but who want to build another line all the way from Korea through Eurasia to Trieste in Italy. So there is a tremendous motion, and this is also supported now by Koizumi from Japan, which is a complete shift in the Japanese-Korean relations. And all of these leaders totally agree that the Eurasian land bridge and the new Silk Road is the way to keep peace and to have a war avoidance policy. So what I'm trying to say is that while the meltdown is going on, while the war danger is escalating, and I will come to that in a second, there are motions of very important forces around the world who basically go in the direction of Lin's policies, the new Bretton Woods and the Eurasian land bridge. So I'm actually very optimistic because people understand that the alternative to war is building peace through economic development, and, you know, have basically a peace plan policy as a counter to this clash of civilization. So I think, you know, this is very optimistic, and I think, you know, there is light on the horizon. But it could not come 1 second too early, because as the French daily newspaper Le Monde published yesterday, and British papers published yesterday and today similar reports, that unfortunately the war is already on. The war against Iraq is already happening. It is happening in the form of an increased air bombardment. There were up to 100 sorties per day. I mean, that is already, I mean, quite a bit. And the idea behind it, according to these newspaper articles, is basically to have, you know, a preparation so that then the air war could go on in earnest in maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and then later followed by a ground war. Now, this is also confirmed by other sources from the region, that there is a massive military buildup in northern Iraq, in Turkey, in Qatar, and, you know, there are B-2 bombers deployed from Diego Garcia for the first time outside of the United States. So the preparation is fully on, and the problem is this has no legal basis. There is no UN resolution. Iraq has agreed to allow the inspectors in. There are no rules of engagement. So what is happening is you have an undeclared covert war without a legal basis. And this is totally unconstitutional. So, you know, the whole world is in an uproar, much, much, much more than anybody inside the United States can possibly know who is not tuned into, you know, either our publications or, you know, the internet or webcasts or so forth. Because what has happened is that with the new military doctrine, which was basically announced by Bush, which calls for a change in the doctrine away from deterrence to preemptive war, and obviously first strike of nuclear weapons and so forth. But, you know, preemptive war, what that means is that basically if a country like the United States can say that they want to have regime change countries they don't like the government of, well, if they start to do that with Iraq, and, you know, Rumsfeld has already indicated that Iran is supposed to be the next one, well, then you have the risk that all hell is breaking out internationally. the international order of law is completely collapsing. Because if the United States takes that right, what should then prevent Russia, for example, of saying, you know, they will completely bomb Chechnya? What should prevent India from saying, look, there is Pakistani terrorism in Kashmir every day. We will cause a regime change in Pakistan. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. We have to get rid of them. What should prevent China from taking Taiwan in a military fashion? What should take anybody to go after their neighbor if they don't like him? So complete chaos would erupt. And what is really at stake is that the entire international body of law, as it developed since the peace office failure after the 30 years religious war in Europe, which lasted from 1618 to 1648, which was then concluded by this wonderful Treaty of Westphalia, which in many senses was really the beginning of international law, and that went then through many phases into the UN and the UN Charter, and you know, the entire body of international law which developed then out of this, this all would be thrown out of the window. So, you know, what we are looking at is an unbelievable crisis. Many, many countries and forces in the world are completely shocked what is coming from this administration. And, you know, it is only by going quickly with the policies of Lyndon LaRouche that you can remedy the situation. And that is being understood in many countries. So, you know, it's a totally turbulent situation and we are in the middle of it. So that is the remarks I wanted to make.
Thank you very much, Helga. And I did get notice in the last few seconds of your giving this update that the statement by Lyndon LaRouche on this dangerous situation that he just made available a few hours ago is now posted on the site www.larouchepub.com. And many of you are on the internet listening to this show, so you now can get that whole statement, Truth in U.S. National Security Policy. And it's LaRouche's open letter to the concerned citizen about this insanity that's taking place and what we can do about it. It's called A Boldly Modest U.S. Global Mission. And I will tell you now, Helga, that just one quick short update, but we have a whole lineup of both emails from London, Canada, and the United States, and also many on the conference line. So in a second, I'm going to say the necessary program announcements we have, and then we're going to go right into this barrage of questions, please. But first, the one thing, as you said, about this good news, both from Germany, but this motion in Italy, a member of the Group of Seven, by the way, the finance ministers are meeting in Washington right now from the Group of Seven. So Italy has made this parliamentary vote for a new financial architecture on behalf of nations. One of the LaRouche Democrats running for office in Michigan 2 days ago held a press conference right away to say this is a gift from Italy, a gift from Europe to the constituents of Michigan to have political motion that can lead the way into a new situation of hope and nation building. And there are many on the conference call. Prepare your questions now for after these announcements I have to make. There are many from other states besides Michigan who can discuss this further and ask Helga what can be done. You're listening to our guest, Helga Zepp-LaRouche from Germany on The LaRouche Show. It's weekly, The LaRouche Show, every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on www.larouchepub.com. You know you can contact us throughout the week at any time to discuss more and see more material at 1-888-347-3258. I'll repeat, 1-888-EIR-3258. And the show you're listening to with Helga Zepp-LaRouche will be archived on the website. Call us in the next few minutes, if you like, in the United States at 1-866-857-4327. Internationally, you can reach us at Area code 703. First dial the country code, then 703-443-8419. Now I will begin with one quick email from London, and it was sent in a half hour ago, saying from Mike, "Hello, 450,000 people turned out for an anti-war march here in London today. It took about 4 hours for the march to pass from the embankment to Hyde Park, about only 2 miles or so. And all the guest speakers commented that oil was the issue in Iraq. Now, undoubtedly the oil lobby would benefit, but in your opinion, what does it matter that the majority of people seem to be unaware of the bigger picture? Are politicians scared to criticize Israel? Is this just an example of dumbing down people for public consumption? And so please comment on the British popular view that Tony Blair is George Bush's lapdog." That's it, Helga from London.
Well, I would not wish to incite lapdogs, you know. I mean, you shouldn't do that. They're normally very nice creatures. Well, I mean, oil definitely plays one role in it. If you think back to Kissinger's memorandum from 1974, when he was National Security Advisor to Nixon, where he wrote in this unbelievable document NSM 200, which people should look up at the internet because it's really a absolutely incredible document, where he says basically that all the raw materials of the world are in U.S. interest, and therefore the U.S. had the right to do whatever they pleased. And that is very clearly one factor, as this totally insane Rand Corporation briefing at the Pentagon in July made clear, where it was suggested, you know, in by Pearl and others, that you know, Saudi Arabia was the enemy number one of the United States, and therefore the Saudi royal family should be gotten rid of, and therefore the United States should occupy the Saudi oil directly. But people in the region understand very well that oil is just one element. What is really at stake is a complete change of all the governments. You know, what is at stake is a kind of a new Sykes-Picot agreement. You remember that the Sykes-Picot Treaty was established after the First World War, dividing the region into countries where national and ethnic questions were not always exactly the reason for drawing up a country, basically with the old British plan to manipulate borders for future conflicts and control. So the redrawing of the map of the region is one big element. And it obviously has also to do with this new debate which has erupted in the United States, that, you know, the United States should be a new global world empire. Now, one big thing is that, you know, when in 1989-90-91, with the collapse of the DDR and the Soviet Union, the actual enemy of NATO or the United States, namely the Warsaw Pact countries, they had disintegrated and disappeared. So at that time, you had a tremendous opportunity to create a new peace order between East and West. And, you know, Mr. LaRouche at that point had suggested first the productive triangle, a kind of LaRouche Marshall Plan for Eastern Europe, and then when the Soviet Union collapsed, to extend that to all of Eurasia and to integrate Eurasia through the infrastructure development with the Eurasian land bridge. That would have meant a true peace order. Unfortunately, the old Bush administration decided to go exactly the other way and to basically let room for the utopian military faction inside the United States to say, okay, now the Soviet Union is gone, now we are the only remaining superpower, and now the United States should become a true empire based on the Roman Empire, on the British Empire. And when Bush Jr. came in, you know, that utopian faction decided that they would take control and, you know, basically do it now. So, you know, this is really not going to work because you cannot subdue the whole world under war, regime change, and all of this. I mean, all you can create is a dark age, but you cannot accomplish. I mean, there is no way how the present policies of the United States will be successful, because either a new war is blowing out the world economy, which everybody in Europe is acutely aware and afraid of, that with this tense financial system, if you now have the cost of war of $2 to $3 billion a day, or you know, an extended war of $2 to $3 trillion a year, plus an oil price of maybe $100 per barrel, which is what the former Saudi oil minister Yamani just said. You know, I mean, this will blow out the system for sure. Plus, you get into an uncalculable series of consequences, you know, with the whole region exploding. So there is no way how the present U.S. policy will be successful. But what we are really looking at is a doomsday scenario, because this is the end of a system. And there are people who say, rather than, you know, allowing that other centers of power emerge, we will take everything down with us.
And I thank you very much, Helga. And I'd like to add, as you are the president of the Schiller Institute, on the website of the Schiller Institute, anyone listening should know you can get the text of a resolution you are circulating on a new Bretton Woods. You formed in 1997 an ad hoc committee for a new Bretton Woods, that is a new financial system for nation building and peace. So look on that at www.schillerinstitute.org, and you can get that text on that site. Now, another email from Canada this time on the German elections. It's from Andy. He asks, since the Chancellor Schroeder is in a coalition with the Green Party, which is anti-technology and anti-growth, how much influence would this party and this thinking have over Germany's policies? Can Schroeder get anything done regarding what needs to be done with them as his partner in the future, Helga?
Well, that's obviously a big problem, because the Greens got, I think, 1 or 2% more than the last time, and they're now demanding more influence and so forth. That is definitely a big limitation in the whole thing. But, you know, I think one should look at this not as a situation which will last very long in any case, because the situation is so fluid and so turbulent in terms of the financial meltdown. And, you know, if we get to the war in earnest, I mean, as I said, it already started, everything will be blown apart. And you can absolutely be sure that in 1 year from now, not one government in Europe, the United States or elsewhere will be in place, nor the policies which now seem to be on the table will play a role. We are heading towards the biggest storm in all of known history. There is no question about it. So I think the Greens profited a lot from Schröder's anti-war stand. But I think, you know, they are part of the reason why we are in this crisis, because they are part of the paradigm shift which caused this collapse to occur. So I think that they will be confronted with some very terrible paradoxes in the very near future.
Yes, thank you. And I'll say to our listeners, thank you, Helga Zeplerush, the new paper by Lyndon LaRouche called Science and Infrastructure. In other words, the very much pro-technology way of building a future. The Science and Infrastructure is out in the Executive Intelligence Review. It is 41 pages. You can see where to get it on the website, www.larouchepub.com. And one quick recommendation to everyone listening on internet or on the conference call is LaRouche's new Science and Infrastructure paper, part of his whole, in the United States, November emergency program to have infrastructure building in this time of crisis, not making war. This is going to be discussed at a live webcast October 3rd. You can listen around the world. It's 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, this live webcast on Science and Infrastructure, LaRouche's Policy. I will give you the website for that because it's being hosted by a LaRouche Democrat in the United States, Nancy Spanis, candidate for U.S. Senator from Virginia. And the website for that discussion, October 3rd, is www.spanisforsenate.com. You spell Spanis, S-P-A-N-N-A-U-S, for F-O-R, Senate.com. Okay, right away we're going to a question from the United States. We have Bill in Philadelphia, and he can go ahead and ask Helga his question directly, Bill.
Okay, Helga, greetings from Philadelphia. I'm back here. You had mentioned that with this breakthrough, this flank plate breaking through in Italy with the introduction of this new Bretton Woods program, that we're immediately pushing to have this similar type of resolution introduced in as many as 12 different nations, and we're working on that immediately. What's going on with that in Europe and other parts of the world? Because I know now we have youth organizations in places like Philippines, and we even have some young people now in places like Nigeria who have student groups on campuses and things like that. Are there any recent developments on that?
What we have been doing in the last 2 days is basically to get the resolution from Italy translated in all languages, and we are circulating it together with the call for a new Bretton Woods, which has a important tradition because I had organized, issued in the past 6 years, two calls. One was an appeal to President Clinton, and when it became clear that Clinton was unfortunately neutralized because of the Lewinsky affair, an ad hoc committee for parliamentarians to just form themselves to make such an emergency conference. These calls were signed by more than 500 parliamentarians from 40 countries and an even larger number of leaders from various civil organizations and trade unionists and industrialists and so forth. So we are recontacting many of these. Some of them are not parliamentarians anymore, therefore we have other new ones. So right now we are basically in the process of really in-depth spreading this proposal. Now, the point is that, you know, a similar development is coming from Latin America, where recently there was a very successful conference in Guadalajara commemorating the 20 years anniversary of López Portillo going with Lin's proposals in 1982. On the 1st September of 1982, President Portillo had started to implement Lin's program for the Latin American wide infrastructure integration, which at that point was called Operation Juarez. And, you know, he introduced exchange controls, nationalized the bank, he gave out development credits for very concrete projects. And at that time, we could have gotten the world on a completely different track. But at that time, Argentina and Brazil did not act in solidarity with Mexico. And Britain had then soon launched the Malvinas War, you know, which you know, threw Argentina way in the crisis. And now people can see that the lack of solidarity in going with LaRouche's proposals implemented by López Portillo is the reason why now not only Argentina is collapsing, but that, you know, basically Brazil and the whole Latin American continent is being Argentinized. So out of this Guadalajara conference, where you had participation from Argentina, from Brazil, came the idea that we need a new global economic forum. You only have two such forums. One is the famous or infamous Davos Forum, in which all the key monetarists meet once a year. And then you have the oligarchical counter-controlled forum of Porto Alegre, in which the so-called anti-globalized forces are organized, but it's actually controlled by the very same forces like the Davos Forum. So the world is in an urgent need to have a real economic forum which discusses physical economy. So I think that it would be one big task also for the United States to find people. So people should take these three documents together: the Italian resolution, the call for new Bretton Woods, and the call to establish a Guadalajara Economic Forum, and try to find people also inside the United States who realize that the whole American model of economy is out, not only the new economy, but, you know, the mega bankruptcies, the collapse of the stock market, and so forth, and find reasonable, intelligent, moral economists in the United States, state legislators, if possible even congressmen, to join, because there's no reason, you know, why we should not be able to find people inside the United States who become part of this world motion. Because, you know, the alternative for the United States obviously is to go back to the policies of John Quincy Adams and the community of principle, because what would be better for the United States than to cooperate with Eurasia, with Africa, with Latin America? I mean, these are potentially gigantic markets for American exports. So, you know, I think what you want is to look for economists in the tradition of Alexander Hamilton, of the Carey father and son, the advisors of Lincoln, in the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and basically, you know, organize them together. Because the problem is, you know, if the whole world is for peace and the United States is going for war, I'm afraid the world will go to war. So the key thing is to break things up, find voices of reason, you know, and I'm absolutely certain that within a couple of days you will see the first signers of this call. We have already six, the first signers who initiated the call, but the idea is to create a momentum, an avalanche of people who say, we don't want to go down the drain of economic depression and war, but we want to put an alternative on the table.
Okay, Conrad, you can ask Helga direct from Las Vegas your question. Conrad, I bet you're there. Go right ahead.
Oh, I just got back on the phone. Grucey.
You go right ahead.
Helga, maybe it's a silly question, but I ask it anyway. Approximately, what's the percentage or how many percent of the people in Germany who knows Lyndon LaRouche and his policy?
Well, I'm absolutely certain that everybody in the political class knows Lyndon LaRouche. There is not one elected politician who doesn't know him. Because we have been involved in German politics for actually 30 years, and, you know, I mean, I'm relatively known also, and obviously people know that I'm that I'm married with Mr. LaRouche, as my name already reveals. So I think that he's very known in the political class. However, I should say this. You know, there was just a very fascinating scandal, a gigantic brawl erupted in Egypt. What happened was that the American ambassador, David Welch, wrote a letter to the editors of the Egyptian newspapers urging them to have censorship concerning coverage concerning the September 11th, who was behind it, and so forth, to absolutely never contradict the American administration's viewpoint. So the Egyptian editors published that letter, and that caused a complete freak out, because then a very large group of intellectuals protested and demanded the resignation of the ambassador, calling him a persona non grata, and, you know, basically saying that they will uphold the freedom of the press in Egypt and they will not allow such cross interference. Now, I think we would be very happy in Germany if we would have similar courageous editors, because the influence of the various U.S. institutions in this country are still much, much bigger. So therefore, we have a much bigger problem with the press, and therefore the German population probably knows Mr. LaRouche only, you know, not as much. I would say, I cannot give you a complete percentage point, but I think what we have accomplished through especially the recent election campaign, where I had a short TV spot which was broadcasted nationally several times, in which I had footage in which Mr. LaRouche appeared. So I think we have made a gigantic step forward, and, you know, I think we have put us on the map in this election campaign with the key concepts, you know, which I think is a very good precondition for the coming crisis.
Thank you, Helga. And I'll combine a couple questions on the German election campaign from Timothy out in California, because he sent in a couple of emails. One about, though, the current strategic situation in the world. He's saying, do you think there's yet more push for the for making war in the face of the financial collapse process that's taking place, and also as opposed to the kind of motion that's developing for a new Bretton Woods? But secondly, on Germany itself historically, Timothy asks that if you look back 100 or so years ago, that at the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century, some say Germany was going to lead the world to a new golden renaissance until the international financial oligarchy moved in, seduced the German people through Hitler. He says, what are your views on this? That is, what are the possibilities that Germany in this motion could still fulfill her destiny of this renaissance? That's from Timothy in California.
Well, concerning the first part of your, or the first question, you know, as I said, without a UN resolution or without any legal basis, the war has already started. I mean, that is the official view. The leading military expert of France had an article 2 days ago in Le Monde, and there were similar articles in the British press basically saying the war has already started. And the big problem is, you know, unless, you know, we are able to turn this around, you know, have the administration change. I mean, they have to change. The problem is they are locked in right now for the war, and it unfortunately is right now on a dynamic, you know, where it is very, very difficult for Bush to get out of it. But I think President Bush should get rid of some of his advisors and put in new advisors. I mean, that's the only chance. Now, concerning Germany, I must say, you know, I mean, Germany had a very great period. This was, you know, almost 200 years ago. The famous German classical period, which started with in music with Bach, then went from in literature, you had the beautiful collaboration between Moses Mendelssohn and Lessing, which laid the foundation then for the actual German classical period, you know, of people like Schiller, Goethe, Beethoven, and many, many others. And, you know, there was a period in which that was really the avant-garde of world culture. And there is no question in my mind that since, you know, Schiller had this beautiful image of man, of that every man should become a beautiful soul, and that you needed the aesthetical education of the population, you know, so that people would discover their inner noble identity and their noble self. And the beautiful thing was that Wilhelm von Humboldt, who was one of the pillars of the German classical period, he, you know, basically grafted these ideas of Schiller into the best education system, in my view, which ever existed, which was the famous humanist Humboldt education system, which basically said that the goal of education should be a beautiful character. and that every pupil, every student should become a state citizen. And that especially through science and art and discovery of great ideas of universal history and so forth. Now, that is still the clue for a new renaissance, because if every child, and that does not only apply for a child, for the children of one country, but, you know, it really applies for the whole world. If every child has the opportunity for a classical education, for, you know, grasping universal history, of learning several languages, especially ancient languages, which sometimes are much more perfect than modern languages, like, for example, the Indian Sanskrit or the ancient Greek, so that you can be more self-conscious about your own language by mastering these other languages. So that if every child would have access to that, well, I mean, then, you know, that's really the end of the oligarchy, because if you have an educated mass of people, who wants to have kings and queens or knights like Knight Alan Greenspan and Knight Sir Weinberger and all of these things? I mean, it becomes ridiculous, you know, because the oligarchy, I mean, that's in America to have knights. Can you imagine this? The American Revolution was made to get rid of this.
I think this is illegal, technically, Helga.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I mean, there are so many people who are making fun out of this, that Greenspan, at the point all bubbles are exploding, is becoming the Knight of the Bubbles.
Yes, that's right.
But anyway, you know, I think that the targeting of Germany was really because, you know, from there you had this method of overcoming oligarchism. So I think, you know, when I think about Germany, I mean, that's still the vision I have, that Germany could play such a role. But given the fact that the destruction of the 20th century was so massive, and the paradigm shift, especially of the last 35 years, has really damaged the population, I think we need a true revolution. And I think Germany at this point can only cooperate with Eurasia, with China, with Russia, with India, with Italy, you know, and hopefully we find our own soul back in this way.
Thank you very much, Helga Zepp-LaRouche, our guest, who's speaking from Germany. And our time is running out. We have a couple more minutes. I want to say one thing. Helga Zepp-LaRouche, I understand in China or Eastern Asia, has been known as the Silk Road Lady, that is the Iron Silk Road Lady of railroads. Helga, you may have seen the fact that this week in Shanghai was test run, the magnetically levitated train. Siemens is part of that consortium. I think it was a big success. But I urge everyone to either check this website or call the phone number in the United States. It's 1-888-347-3258. So that you can get the kind of documents in writing, know where to get them, for mass circulation, for leafleting, no matter what the political blackout now. The motion is on our side, as Helga Zepp-LaRouche describes, for a new future of hope. And thank you for listening to The LaRouche Show. And Helga, I hope you'll be back again very soon.
Okay.